Hello and welcome to this, the seventh episode of the Radical Americas podcast. Later in this episode, I speak to Ben Bollig about Vasquez Real and crime fiction, and also to Neil Geraghty about aspects of Argentine cinema. But first of all, also on a cinema theme, I speak to Camila Gatica.
This is William Booth for the Radical Americas podcast. I'm here at the British Library talking to Dr. Camila Gatica, and we'll be talking about a few things today. Camila is a stipendiary fellow at ILAS here in London, also teaching at the Universidad Católica in Santiago, after a stint at Warwick teaching history and cinema. Good morning, Camila.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Quite all right. So we'll talk first about the project that you've been doing at ILAS, which is on indecency, with the title Controlling the Body, Decency in Argentina, 1850 to 1945. So perhaps you could give us a summary of that project.
So that project basically comes out of a few ideas that emerged while writing the second chapter of my PhD, which was on censorship in Buenos Aires and Santiago. And I kept seeing censorship being attached to or being linked to concepts of morals and being culturally moral. And I thought, kind of, where is this coming from? How are they defining morals? And then the idea of Carreño, maybe kind of everything is coming from ideas of decency, what is decent from Carreño, because decency was another concept that kept popping out. Mm. Like, movies should be decent.
Yeah.
The content of films should be decent and should be moral, but what does that mean? So I ended up just rereading Carreño for reasons. And I thought maybe there's a connection here. So I put together this project, which basically linked some of the ideas that we see in Carreño's writings with the emergence of other manuals on behaviors and civility and how to be like proper in the urban context that start being written in Argentina by Argentines, basically following Carreño's footsteps, but for an Argentine context. Mm. And link that with the emergence of regulations on how to behave in the cinema that I had because of my thesis.
Yeah.
So, that's how that sort of came up.
So there's two types of decency there, I suppose. There's decency on screen and decency in the seats.
Yeah.
And how are those defined? Are they fairly coherent ideas of what decency is and where the line is drawn?
Not really. So what is really interesting to me is that, in my opinion, what they're trying to control when they are essentially controlling the content of films, or trying to control, because they don't really actually control anything.
Okay.
The content of films, they are actually trying to control how people watch them.
Mm.
So although it's phrased and worded in a way that it's meant to be for the content, what they're trying to do is educate the population and trying to hold some sort of idea of what the population should be. So it's sort of this idea that they're trying to create the ideal citizen, or the citizen that they want to present. What is kind of a proper Buenos Aires person? What's a proper porteño? How do they behave?
Yeah.
Or how they're meant to behave?
Yeah.
So a way of doing this is trying to control cinema, because so many people were going to the cinema. So how do you put some sort of control into this without that kind of that getting out of hand?
Mm. And is the idea of decency that they use a positive one, i.e. they want the films to project a certain role model, or is it a negative one with certain things that they're not allowed to do, or is it hard to pick those things apart?
It's a mixture of it, but they do, the way that they do word it is that it needs to be decent and it needs to be moral so that it's cultural.
Mm.
So that's actually quite positive if you think about it. The problem is that the way they assert that, it might not be as positive as it's worded. But it is a little bit of don't do this in the cinema, and a little bit of we shouldn't allow this to be shown because of this reason. But the really interesting thing with Argentina is that they didn't have previous censorship.
Mm.
So they weren't allowed to actually censor before the film was seen. What they did do, though, particularly during the Second World War, was to prohibit films from scratch. So yeah. They prohibited this film called Confessions of a Nazi Spy. It's a joke. It's really, really funny, but it's not meant to be.
Okay.
So it's about this Nazi ring that has infiltrated the US, and they have the plans for this weapon or weapons in the Navy or something like that, and they need to uncover it and stop the Nazis. They also prohibited The Great Dictator.
Yeah.
So that wasn't seen, and this other film wasn't seen until 1945.
Okay.
And many other films. Well, at the same time, they were deeming cultural and decent and morally correct a bunch of films that were pro-fascism, essentially.
Right.
So there's a political aspect, particularly in those years, that is quite interesting. Mm. But the way that they phrase all of it is within the boundaries of cultural and morals and decency. So it's really interesting how it's really flexible. It's really plastic as a concept.
Yeah. So a lot of this is about, so where there is something concrete that's being discouraged, it's perhaps about challenging authority or hierarchy or orders.
Yeah, in a way. And what is interesting is, although, yeah, some authorities are actually pushing for some films to being shown, although they're not appropriate in, it's not what we would call decent and
yeah.
we would call moral and cultural. They are they're calling it that because they want to show it because it's within their thought. But the interesting thing is that people within the cinema industry were not happy with this, and they call on this.
Right.
Say, this is not correct.
Yeah.
Do something about it.
Okay.
So there is the two sides of the coin kind of thing.
Yeah. So it's not particularly what we might think of as a decency that comes out of religion or a decency that comes out of...
There's an aspect of that because Argentina is a Catholic country.
Yeah.
So there's inevitably an aspect of that that I should definitely explore further. Because I think at some level I just gave it as a certainty, but
yeah.
it should be something that is more explored.
Yeah.
Because the church is really into films. They
yeah.
very quickly realized how the importance of them.
Yeah. And what about the other side of it with the behavior in cinemas? What's going on that's not meant to happen, and what would they prefer to see?
Oh, they were this characters called the Faunos, who basically just went in cinemas to bother young girls. And cinemas were famously a place for them, for people, not for them, but for people in general to just be together.
Yeah.
Because of the lights. There's an intimacy that comes with the lack of lights.
Mm.
So there's some really interesting dynamics between what is public and what is private.
Yeah.
How do we construct space socially and the things that we put into that space that make it work in some specific ways with the lack or presence of light?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of behaviors happening there, but the way that they sort of norm it is to by slowly introducing things that are very natural for us today. The fact that there's always a bit of light in the cinema,
yeah.
those sort of things. And there's scientific reasons for that. So you see a lot of studies being done of how much cinema or being in a cinema that is completely with no light at all, it can damage our eyesight.
Okay.
So and they start using that as well as publicity for the eye people start using it as publicity. Come on.
Yeah.
If you're going alone to the cinema and your eyesight is starting to bother you, you should go to the eye doctor.
Yeah.
And we will make you some nice glasses.
Yeah.
Anything.
I think that's that kind of interaction there of morality and commerciality, and I kind of
yeah.
really
it's
interesting
all
way.
A big mush.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that came to mind is wondering about whether this has a kind of class or, the interaction of white Argentinian morality and indigenous morality might be it's a very different story from what it is in Mexico, for instance. But I've seen instructional videos from around the time of the Olympics in 1968 in Mexico where there were adverts, which I think were in the cinema, but maybe were on television as well, about decent behaviour in the eyes of the world. And so the world is going to be looking, and the kind of subtext of all this is, for goodness sake, don't act like a Mexican. And it's really, so they have cantinflas, you know, sitting, squatting in the street or spitting, and all things that they're sort of framing as public decency and behaviour.
Well, Mexico had a whole thing on prohibiting films that did not make them look in the way that they wanted to be portrayed. And that's often the case with regulations in cinema. There's always one that basically points to the fact that you should not represent other nations in a poor manner.
Yeah.
But particularly with US films, the Mexican government was really sort of harsh. Like, we will not be mocked.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But that's not such a preoccupation in Argentina.
There are a couple of articles on it, people complaining. And I think it gets particularly bad during the Good Neighbor policy years. Mm. They start making these films for some reason, like Carmen Miranda is in the middle of Buenos Aires singing. She's not actually, but she's because of montage, she's being put there. Which is very strange. It's all conceptions of what Latin Americanism and means, and it's all a mush to the US, isn't it?
Well, indeed, as you see in something like Tres Caballeros.
No, that is just a wonderful film. Like all the the piñata thing and the loudness of it and the colourful of it.
Yeah. It's just the details don't matter as long as you're in the coalition of the willing.
Yeah, exactly.
So this came out of a part of your doctoral project, and perhaps we move back to that, which is something you're working on transforming into a book at the moment, which is called Social Practices of Modernity, Cinema Going in Buenos Aires and Santiago, 1915 to 1945. So give us a sense of what the thrust of that project was.
I was really interesting to see to try to understand how the cinema space is constructed, and thinking about cinema architecturally and as a physical space, thinking about it as a technological space, thinking about it as a sociability space. So that basically, kind of out of those questions came my doctoral thesis, which was trying to understand cinema from these different perspectives, but mainly through reception. So I wasn't, and I've never actually been, although you can call me a cinema historian, I'm actually not. I've never been interested in production. I like going to the cinema and I watch a lot of cinema, but that's not my academic interest. So in many ways, what I do is try to register what people thought of the films they were watching.
You're sitting in the corner looking at the audience,
I'm
not the screen.
I'm the creep looking at the people watching the films. Because I wanted to understand how cinema as a phenomenon was received.
Yeah, because it's so revealing, isn't it, as this kind of node of, it's where past meets present and future. And
there's a lot of tensions between what the government wants and what the people want and the entertainment people. So there are a lot of interests coming together in this one entertainment, and the whole sort of building up of cinema from a curiosity into entertainment, into the validation of the higher classes, into this art form. It's really interesting, and you see all of that happening in the first half of the 20th century, in my opinion. So this is basically why I chose to focus on these years, on the first half, and what I decided to use as my sources due to geographical issues. Because I was doing it in London and focusing on Latin America, you very well know the sources, they are an issue, a particular issue.
Yes.
Where are they? Where
to
go?
We don't make it easy for ourselves.
Yeah, no, at all. But I was in Latin America and decided to come here. Whenever people ask me, it's like, what?
This would be far easier on the other side of the world from where
I'm but
materials.
Also, the decisions we make.
Indeed.
What I wanted to do was mainly focus, because I wasn't focusing on the production of it, I was focusing on reception. I decided that the easiest way to do this was to particularly use cinema specialized magazines for my main sources. So I used other documents and stuff, but those are my main things. So I basically spent a long time reading through cinema magazines that start sort of exploding during the disease, like 1915. That's when a lot of these magazines started being published.
Yeah, and Argentina is relatively close to the forefront of these technological developments within Latin America, isn't it?
They're always, that was really funny, because they're always trying to invent a machine that does exactly what another machine does. It's probably, I'm sorry for the Argentines listening to this, but it's the most Argentinian
brutal
thing
body
ever.
Argentina there.
So trying to, they do really cool stuff. Like they have one person trying to actually put sound into film way before sound was put into film.
Yeah.
Or a special kind of, so when, again, during the late 1930s, there's an embargo on film.
Yeah.
The U.S. is not selling them film because they use it as a measure of pressure, essentially, for them to make up their minds.
Yeah.
So they start thinking about how to make film.
Yeah.
Which is really cool if you think about it, but it's also very Argentine. Sorry, Argentinians.
So this... if we think about the social side of it for a bit, do you think on the whole cinema ends up being more a place of the breakdown of social boundaries and hierarchies, or is it more on balance one of enforcing and making more rigid those hierarchies?
I think there is a breakdown, which is really interesting, but at the same time, because it's so, you can always pay for it, it's so cheap.
Yeah.
So it's affordable, at least once a week.
Yeah.
In a way, there is another way that cinemas themselves regulate that sort of class element or social element, if you want to put it in more general terms, which is through pricing.
Yeah.
So they do have different prices for different sections. So that's a way that... that gets regulated. And another way it gets regulated is that there are cinemas that probably the elite attends more than others. And you have the cines de barrio, which are in the barrios.
Yeah.
Very fairly basic. And then the central cinemas or the premier cinemas. So it was more likely for people from the elite or people from the higher classes to go to the cinemas where they were doing premieres and to go to cinemas that were washer, essentially.
Yeah.
And then the barrios, those are really, really cheap, so it's more likely to see other kind of attendees.
Yeah.
So that's a way that it regulates. So there's a geographical aspect that is really interesting, but this doesn't mean, and this was one of my first ideas that kind of crumbled down, I thought that people were moving a lot.
Yeah.
Or that they were moving a lot in order to assert their elegance and assert their the fact that they were from the elite, but actually no, they don't really mind. They just go to the cinema that is closest, or go to the cinema that is showing the film that that they want to see.
Yeah.
So what's moving them, there is movement, what is moving them is not a class thing, it's an entertainment thing.
Yeah.
There probably is a class element if they're going to the Splendid to see a premiere, but it's very likely that the people who got tickets for that are...
Yeah.
Hierarchy.
But that says something about agency on the part of the audience, doesn't it? And that there's already a kind of discernment, and they're not just taking what's put on the screen.
Oh, no. There's a whole element of appropriation that is really, really key to this. So by understanding reception as a two-way street.
Yeah.
So it's not an imposition.
Yeah.
Cinema is chosen as an entertainment that they want to see. They want to go to the cinema. So it's not European films being shoved down their throats, and the same thing with the US after the First World War, which is when that industry sort of really booms up. It's about choices, and both in Santiago and in Buenos Aires, the audiences like these films, and they ask for specific films, and they ask for specific cinema. They really love French cinema, for instance. So with the war, when they start getting less cinema, what they do is start repricing films, and they re-premiere them in this whole events because we really miss French cinema. So there is this kind of demand and offer thing that is very, very key to understanding that reception.
Yeah.
But that actually means that it's not, nothing's being shoved on anyone.
No.
There's a lot, a key thing here is choice. and how that impacts the industry and the industry of cinema going, not the industry of production necessarily.
The dialectic.
Don't make fun of me and my words.
No. Well, no, that's more making fun of me. So moving on to your postdoctoral work, the Centre for International Educational Cinema, which is a kind of international League of Nations project.
During the late 1920s, the League of Nations takes on this project that comes from the Italian government with Mussolini on its head, on trying to push for the production of educational films in an international manner.
Mm.
And this comes with basically making it affordable and making it possible for the production of educational films to be done worldly, meaning to raise fees and raise and kind of take out taxes.
Yeah.
To be possible for these films to transit the world in a transnational manner.
Yeah.
And what I want to do is to see how, basically, if Mexico, Chile, and Argentina, how these three countries hopped on board of this project.
Yeah.
Because I think there's an element of this, but I want to see to which level this was a thing.
Mm.
Because technically, all the League of Nations countries could kind of get into this program.
Yeah.
But being a Latin Americanist, I'm focusing on those countries. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, so I've started doing a bit of research for. So I went to the archives of the League of Nations, and there's so many documents signed by Mussolini. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
In a sort of professional way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of. I mean, effectively, this is an analogy for reducing tariff barriers. Or like they're free traders, but for cultural production.
Yeah.
When at the same time there's, you know, extremely protectionist states in other ways. That's some kind of interesting tensions there, and whether this is, are they even seeing this really as an economic, but part of economic policy, or is this that cultural production is special and therefore needs to be protected from the vicissitudes and the fickleness of the market?
It's a little bit of both, I think. I haven't gone into it as kind of further enough to be able to answer that completely. But what I will say is that the educational aspect of it, that it's not casual. Mm. It's really, really important. And it comes together with, again, censorship.
Yep.
Not that I'm obsessed with it. With censorship. And because for a long time, cinema was seen as a tool of education.
Yeah.
So this was a project that was meant to enhance that, to really push for cinema to become the instrument that it could be.
Yeah.
Which was an educational tool.
Yeah.
Because it was accessible, because everyone could see them. So I have no idea, for example, if a set amount of films from Italy, let's say, got dubbed or subtitled and shown everywhere. I don't know if the production, the educational film production from Latin American countries traveled as well, or traveled within Latin America. Those are the sort of questions that I want to find out. But it's the education, the education word of it. It's really, really key to understanding the role that governments sort of latch on to cinema.
Yeah, and education as a political tool is such a preoccupation of all these governments in that period. You know, and ultimately the aim there is not to have a kind of value neutral, better educated person. It's to have a Mexicano that fits into a bracket, or an Argentino that fits
the
into
ideal
a
citizen
exactly
thing.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about this is that how do you make up a world citizen?
Yeah, and do you really want to? Because that's quite a dangerous thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's. So one of the issues that project is still very much in pañales.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to get a little bit of funding to, like, really start doing proper research.
Yeah.
Still so many documents that I need to go through.
Yeah.
Not only in the League's archive, but also back home and in Argentina and hopefully in Mexico.
Where is the League's archive?
In Paris, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for speaking to Radical Americas about all your projects. I look forward to the book coming out happen in the medium term. And
thank you.
We'll keep an eye out for things that come out of all these projects, and we'll put a link to your previously published work in the blurb under the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me and for having this lovely conversation with me.
Thank you.
And thanks to Camilla there. Next, I spoke to Ben Bollig, my St. Catherine's College colleague.
This is William Booth for the Radical Americas podcast. I'm here at St. Catherine's College in Oxford talking to one of my colleagues, Ben Bollig, who's been here since 2011, and in 2016 was elevated to Professor of Spanish American Literature. He's also an editor of the Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies and a contributor to the public sphere, which is something we'll come back to later. But I thought we might begin today with crime writing. Ben, you're perhaps best known as an expert on poetry, but crime writing is something which is lurking there or thereabouts. So perhaps we could start with why this is such an important genre or form within Latin American culture.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I suppose I've had an interest in crime writing going back a long way, really, even as a student, reading writers like Roberto Alt and of course, Borges, who you don't necessarily think of crime writers in the strictest sense, but they've very much explored how crime is an important social phenomenon, and also in the case of both Alt and Borges, used formal aspects of crime writing in their own fiction. And I sort of had this as an interest in the background, and I finally got to do something a couple of years ago when I wrote a piece on crime and money for the Bulletin of Spanish Studies. And I was looking at a series of phenomena that had I hadn't really thought how they were linked, but they were writers like Alt, also Ricardo Piglia and his novel Plata Quemada, another novel I'd read which I found very interesting, Alan Bowles' Historia del Dinero, Story of Money. And what I realised that they all had in common was that they were interested in how money worked and what money was. Mm. And they all investigated this question, which it seems that, you know, economists even to this day don't have a decent answer to, which is what actually is money. And in Argentina, a country which has had a series of economic collapses and, you know, it's changed currency on a number of occasions. And, you know, while I was doing my PhD research, actually had this, well-known economic collapse and the flotation of the peso, etc. I thought this was really interesting. And so what I wanted to look at was how writing, with reference to a kind of genre fiction or popular fiction, how these authors could explore a philosophical question, but also a really, really important everyday question. I mean, particularly looking today in Argentina with inflation and the peso going out to about 28 to the dollar as of today. And as I started sort of reading more, I became interested in the problem of genres in a different context. And there's a quotation from Carlos Gamero, who's a brilliant contemporary Argentine novelist. And he says that you've got to rethink crime writing in a context in which if anybody finds a dead body, they automatically assume that the police committed the crime. And so he says, you've got this problem because crime fiction relies on a certain social assumptions about law and order, about trusting the police. It's, in Argentina, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who, if they witness a crime, would immediately think the best thing to do is to go and talk to the police. And so he comes up with these kind of 10 rules for crime fiction in Argentina. And they're things like, anybody accused by the police is automatically innocent. The story should begin not with the discovery of a body, but with the disappearance of a body. And he's being, in the one sense, humorous and satirical. And he has a very strong position regarding the police in Argentina. But on the other hand, he points to something that's really important in the history of crime fiction and crime writing in the Americas, which is that the genre is changed, is twisted for it to make sense. And it often appears as a kind of pastiche. Mm. So, I mean, the very earliest crime writing in Latin America is a story like La Bolsa de Huesos, The Bag of Bones by Holmberg. So it's from 1896. And on the one hand, it takes that kind of Sherlock Holmes model of the ratiocinative detective. but already it's self-referential. So it refers to itself as a novel, so that the characters talk about this as a work of fiction. So it's already aware of the rules of the game, and it's already playing with them and twisting them. And so one of the things that was very interesting for me was how crime writing in Latin America is aware of the fact that it's a genre, it's aware of the model, but it also knows how it's got to adapt to be credible, to be plausible in a different socio-political context.
Mm. And is that awareness tied up in the fact that it can't operate in a silo? It's always, you know, as you said, it's a genre out of context, but it's also a genre with tentacles in all kinds of other contexts, and it can't escape from politics, it can't escape from memory, it can't escape from generalised ideas of violence. How does it deal with those multiple interactions?
Yeah, that's right. And in the first instance, in the example of the earliest practitioners, so there's a Chilean crime writer from the 1910s and 20s called Miguel Fuensalida. There's a Mexican writer from the sort of 40s called Antonio Elú, and they do it through pastiche. So there's a famous example of a Mexican locked room puzzle where the solution, and sort of spoiler alert here, the solution is that it's a partially constructed house with no roof, and that's the big reveal. So it's a joke about development, construction, political corruption in Mexico. So one of the ways they do this initially is pastiche. And if you look at kind of Borges's his sort of excursions into crime writing, something like Death and the Compass, so there Lönnrot the detective is on the one hand he's the kind of classic reasoner, but he overthinks everything. So towards the end of that, he can't even open a door without overthinking, and he takes this absurd detour because he can't pull a gate open. And so that's kind of about the risks of excessive reasoning, excessive rationalism. So initially, what happens is it's through pastiche and through parody, or through kind of taking the genre to its most ridiculous extent, which is probably what Borges does, or with his the stories he wrote with Buey Cáceres, Isidro Parodi stories, where the detective, he's such a thinker that he's in jail, and so he resolves all his crimes without actually ever leaving jail. But then later, you see more of an influence of noir, and particularly sort of the D.L. Hammett model, where you're not, it's not the forces of the state, it's not necessarily a kind of conservative genre in the way that people have always argued that the cozy crime detections are. And you see much more investigation of the kind of police, politics, corruption nexus. And so someone like Osvaldo Soriano is a really interesting case, an Argentine writer. And Soriano, his first efforts are parodies. So it's a kind of, he's an Argentine in Hollywood with a, with a washed up Philip Marlowe and the bad guy Stan Laurel. So it's kind of an elaborate joke. There's a kind of fight with John Wayne at one stage. But then when he writes what in Spanish is called No Bromas Penas Ni Olvido, but in English is called A Funny Dirty Little War, as the film was titled, there he's using the kind of Hammett model of hard-boiled, tough crime fiction to investigate corruption within Peronism. He was a sort of left Peronist, and in the early 70s he felt that Peronism was being overtaken by a sort of these kind of thuggish right-wing elements linked to the military and the sort of paramilitary apparatus. And so there he uses the Hammett style crime model to investigate political corruption. And so you see this development again where you go from the sort of cozy crime, the sort of ratiocinative detectives, towards the noir and the neo-noir. And there, that's a genre that becomes really useful for investigating and for talking about political corruption.
In Latin America, it's almost unimaginable, apart from in a few very specific places, to imagine that you can separate police corruption from politics. I think you can sometimes get in a British context or even other European contexts, I suppose, as well, in crime fiction or television, this idea that corruption is something internal to the police and that all you need is a cleaning of the house.
Yeah.
I suppose David Peace kicks back against that to a significant extent. But in Latin America, the idea that the police corruption and politics could be separated like that is really unimaginable.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I mean, there's some examples of people trying to write more sort of faithful police procedurals. There's an author called Ernesto Macho, an Argentine writer, and he's got this detective, Inspector Lascano, El Perro Lascano, the dog Lascano. And his argument is, statistically, given the number of people employed by the police force, there must be one honest detective. And, you know, you can kind of read the novels and see whether that's convincing or not. He's got, you know, he's popular, he's enjoyable, but it rests on something that many people will question as being deeply problematic. Another approach, someone like Claudia Piñeiro, Thursday Night Widows, which is a really interesting crime novel, because there isn't really a detective. There's people who are at risk, but there isn't really a kind of centre of the detection. There's people who are threatened because of this kind of political corruption, economic corruption. And the novel, on the one hand, is a really interesting exploration of the social circumstances that fed into, led up to, preceded the collapse of the early 2000s. But also it's a detective story without a formal detection. I mean, interestingly, I mean, the one example that really springs to mind is someone like Rodolfo Walsh, and he really speaks to precisely what you've just said about how the sort of diffuse nature of political corruption and how that links to crime. He starts out writing quite orthodox crime stories, so the Variations in Red are, you know, very clever variants on, is it a suicide, is it a murder type mysteries. And then he writes Operation Massacre, Operation Massacre, which is his investigation of extrajudicial killings in the wake of the coup against Perón. And he starts out very much from the kind of legalistic pro-establishment figure. You know, he was quite a conservative individual, and over the course of this kind of new journalistic style investigation, he comes to realise that actually the system is rotten. And so what he'd wanted to do was work within the existing legal frameworks. But over the course of the investigation, he discovers, and it's fascinating to see this playing out in the work itself, he discovers that you can't. And then the result of that, you see throughout the rest of his career as a writer and a political activist, which is his turn ever more to the radical left. And that's what would lead to his eventual murder at the hands of the dictatorship in 76.
Mm. I mean, the question I often set in Latin American politics courses is, who governs Mexico, for instance? And of course you get answers on the government, answers on the cartels, but it'd be very interesting to get an answer on the judiciary and the police, which is, of course, speaking in two directions in a way that only they can.
Yeah, yeah, and that's absolutely that's absolutely central to many of these crime fictions. And that's, so Walsh kind of starts out thinking that the police basically works and the judiciary is honest, and then he tries to kind of prosecute this case within the existing legal frameworks, but it you can sort of see the realization that isn't going to work. I mean, thinking of a more recent and really kind of compelling piece of crime writing, not a fiction, by Selva Almada, work called Chicas Muertas, Dead Girls. Mm. I've sort of blogged on this elsewhere, and that's about a series of, I suppose, what you call femicides. They're murders of young women in northern Argentina in the 1980s, all of which were no one's ever been successfully prosecuted for them. And one of the things that she discovers, alongside a kind of prevailing cult of machismo, is even when you find the kind of decent members of the police force, is the combination of resources and incompetence is absolutely loaded against any kind of successful investigation. And probably the most chilling thing that she discovers in all of this is that one set of remains that they have, that have always been assumed to be one of the victims of this femicide, they discover, years later, it's somebody else. And it means two things. One is that the the forensic process has been completely flawed, but two, somebody's lost a relative and doesn't dare look for them.
And that kind of darkness is repeated in many other contexts, and that might be a good point to bring us on to Bolaño, perhaps.
Yeah.
Of course, that brings to mind that enormous middle section of 2666.
The part about the crimes. And Bolaño is a really interesting author from this point of view, because you'd never think of him as a crime writer per se. Maybe the nearest he gets to that is one of the early works, the skating rink, La Piste de Hielo, where he uses this sort of polyvocal approach of having three characters all involved in a kind of series of love triangles, but also all who are linked to and implicated in some way in a murder, in this extraordinary central image of a clandestine skating rink in an abandoned palace on the Catalan coast somewhere. And so there he kind of obliges, a bit like what Borges does as well, he kind of obliges the reader to be a detective, to try and pick through these testimonies, to pick through these sort of first-person accounts in which you get the impression that everyone is lying.
Yeah.
But that use of kind of crime fiction staples, you can see it throughout 2666, and particularly the part about the crimes, is a Kafkaesque police procedural. And it's not for nothing that the five different sections, the initials spell out Kafka, albeit with a C rather than a K. But it's as Cortázar once said, if Kafka was in Mexico, he'd be a realist. And that section, which is obviously horrifying and appalling, but yet at the same time, actually strangely and deliberately boring.
Yeah.
Just get time and again these terrible details just repeated over and over again of the femicides in northern Mexico. But so what he's doing there is kind of twisting the police procedural to a situation in which it's utterly absurd, in which it's a farce. Similarly, thinking about Distant Star as well, and there you have a detective who's a specialist, his most famous crime that he's solved is a version of the locked room puzzle. But of course he's called in to investigate crimes committed by the Pinochet dictatorship and their goons, where there's no such possibility of a simple solution. So I think, Bolaño is a really fascinating example of someone for whom the crime genre and crime as a social phenomenon and its links to politics and political violence and corruption play a really central role in his narrative.
Hmm. Well, I wonder if this is a good time to come on and talk about Vázquez Rial. But and you've got your piece in Radical America's Unreasonable Doubt, Politics and Aesthetics in the Crime Novels of Horacio Vázquez Rial.
Yeah, so Vázquez Rial is a writer who I first read quite a long time ago, and I remember being really struck by his style as much as anything. So he's writing in that sort of mid-80s, and he's writing these sort of really quite early Elroy-esque, David Peace-esque, ultra-violent, ultra-hard-boiled, neo-noir thrillers, really, and they're set in the world of the armed insurgency in the 1970s, and also the sort of para-police, paramilitary repression. But yet they're also informed by a kind of these extraordinary right-wing conspiracies about what was going on in the politics of Argentina in the 1970s. And I read him, and I sort of kept coming back to him and picking up another novel here and there. And what I was really interested in is this relationship between an author who, on the one hand, is he's pioneering, he's stylistically innovative, he's incredibly compelling, but also this really very conservative politics. And I was kind of inspired by something that a colleague of mine at Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies, Jens Anderman, said was, that the need to take seriously the conspiracy theories of the right and this kind of conspiratorial discourse that emerged, particularly in the run-up to the 2015 elections in Argentina, where the sort of right-wing commentators on, you know, on television and in La Nación were kind of throwing all these sort of fairly absurd accusations at the Kirchnerista government and say, we kind of need to take this conspiratorial discourse seriously. And it made me think, well, it's time to go back to Vázquez Rial and look at how someone who is ostensibly, you know, formerly a very radical writer, can on the other hand be politically very conservative. And I was particularly interested in these novels from the 80s because, as well as being, you know, an extraordinary read, they also see, you see them at this point of flux or this juncture where, like many people on the right in Argentina, he's going from his youthful militancy in anarchist left-wing groups and then actually as a member of the armed left in the early 70s to someone who would fashion himself as a liberal, but actually, for, you know, most of us would consider him to be a fairly reactionary figure politically. Yeah. And they're written just at that moment when he's reneging on his previous commitment to the armed left, and he's charting a course into something kind of much more conservative. And to do that, he fashions this, well, kind of really kind of extraordinary conspiracy theory about the history of the Argentine left. And I suppose, in a sense, the answer kind of I found it in looking at Adorno and aesthetic theory and some of the things that he says about how the politics comes out in the form of the writing. And that's really what I was trying to explore with that piece.
Yeah, and it taps into that this kind of Chesterton, Conrad infiltration, agent provocateur history, and really runs with it in quite a spectacular way.
Yeah, he certainly does. Yeah, this idea that effectively sort of Mondoneros was a creation of the military, and then he's got these kind of deep suspicions about Peronism as well, some of what he says is totally kind of fanciful, but at the same time also because he knew the group so well, having militated in them, there's this truthiness about the whole thing, let's say. And I was, you know, also thinking particularly of all the conspiracy theories in the run-up to the last US elections as well. And there's this, you know, if you've got enough kind of verifiable facts in there, and then you throw in a few other things, and I suspect from your point of view as a historian, this is particularly galling, but there's this kind of veneer of truth which comes with a mixture of verifiable facts, things that are more or less plausible, and then also just throwing in some kind of completely wild accusations as well, that enables you then effectively to kind of chuck mud at your political opponents, and some of it will stick, and then at the same time also there's the affect as the kind of creation of certain emotions around political figures, which seems to be, you know, there Vázquez Rial in the 1980s is already doing something that we've become really used to in the 2010s.
Yeah, it's very ahead of its time. And I think, I mean, from my point of view as a historian, the things that seem to come together in all of this, and it does, as you say, have echoes in the recent US election and also in lots of European politics over the last 3 years, in this combination of, you know, post-9/11, post-global financial crisis, add in social media, and those things together seem to have this combustible way of fueling conspiracy theories or half-truths or however you want to put it. So a good writer to look at in our contemporary period, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also another kind of one of those significant differences or points of contrast between Europe and Latin America. I think in David Aronovich's book about conspiracy theories, and he's obviously very very critical of the conspiratorial mindset that he calls it, and he debunks a number along the way. But then he basically says, well, but in Latin America, because actually there have been organised plans by governments to wipe out large sections of the population, then you can see why people are more prone to believe conspiracy theories.
Yeah, it's when do they stop being conspiracy theories and just descriptions of conspiracy.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, I thought perhaps we'll move on to talk about something that you had in TLS recently on Neruda, where you reviewed these two new collections and which you conclude by saying they serve as a reminder of the good and the not-so-good in Neruda. And so perhaps we could take a little bit of the good first and then come back to the not-so-good.
Yeah, I mean, the good is that Neruda at his, you know, at his great moments, makes us look at the world anew. The world in Neruda is bigger, more striking, more compelling, more emotional, more colourful, and that's really something that, you know, in that encounter with Neruda, you know, the first time one reads Alturas de Machu Picchu or even something like Estravagario, a later collection, it's that initial encounter with this really eye-opening world that he describes. So just make this a world that is dramatic and compelling and infused with emotion and sentiment. And at the same time, what I was interested in from teaching Neruda is how increasingly I find kind of students questioning aspects of his writing, of his politics, of his sexual politics as well. And so when they asked me to write the piece, yeah, initially it was quite a sort of small-scale thing. These are two relatively minor works. I mean, Venture of the Infinite Man is a very important collection from the point of view of Neruda's development as a writer, and also important, obviously, from Neruda's studies, because it's a kind of a hinge work, let's say. But it's still, not as important as some of the other big collections. And then also this collection of kind of late odes of works that were found in amongst his posthumous papers. And then come back, it's called in English. So there were two kind of relatively minor pieces, but one of the things they asked me at the TLS was, look, you know, if I wanted to also reflect more widely about Neruda's importance today. And one of the questions I kind of was trying to get around is, Neruda very successfully self-fashions in his poems. Obviously, those of us who do literary studies, we've been, you know, sort of brought up with this idea of the sort of autobiographical fallacy, and that, you know, we shouldn't say that, yeah, that texts are about their authors. But one of the things that Neruda has always did in his works was make this character of Neruda. And yeah, obviously it's a pseudonym to start with, so there's a work of self-fashioning just in the very name. But from the love poems through to the political work, the Civil War poetry, through to Canto General, all the way to the very end, there's this process of self-fashioning. And on top of that, of course, he's a huge public figure, yeah, as well. And I had seen Pablo Larraín's film, Neruda.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking that portrayal of him, it reminded me of another contemporary political figure who's often described as a kind of big baby. And I was thinking, there's this sort of megalomania in Neruda. And I couldn't watch that film without having this sort of almost horrible image of Neruda as a kind of Donald Trump figure, which may seem completely absurd. But in the portrayal in Larraín's film, there's a kind of capriciousness about him. And also reading something like Jorge Edwards' memoir, Adios Poeta, and he worked alongside him in the diplomatic service and was very close to him in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And Neruda's sort of, let's say, his kind of megalomania, let's say. So what was interesting for me was, on the one hand, this incredibly compelling poetry that you can't overlook, but at the same time also this self-fashioning as a writer, and the fact that means some of the more problematic areas of his biography become very difficult to unpick from the poetry, and in particular when the poetry touches on those areas which are probably more problematic in his life, which are sex and politics, basically.
Yeah, and so this kind of picks up on in a slightly overly simplistic way in this debate about whether we can separate art from artists, because the point of it is, you know, Neruda doesn't separate art from artists. It's all bound up in this story of Neruda, whether it's constructed or whether it's narrated.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I've had conversations with friends who are writers about this, and they say there's this sort of hard line approach to Neruda, which is, because, you know, he admitted in his memoirs that basically he'd committed rape when he was in Sri Lanka in the 1920s, and it's described in sort of, you know, sort of gruesome detail in his memoirs, and both you know, Feinstein and in the recent biography by Mark Eisner, yeah, they analyse this particular incident and you know, don't in any way attempt to excuse him. So on the one hand, it would be absurd to just, I think it would be absurd to say, well, you know, he committed a despicable act, so therefore we can't read his writing. It's like saying, you know, with Einstein's diaries, this, you know, revelation that Einstein had very questionable attitudes on race that he wrote in, you know, so you wouldn't say, you know, Einstein was a racist, so therefore we can't read the theory of, we can't accept the theory of relativity. But on the other hand, with Neruda, when you've got lines such as, you know, me gustas cuando callas porque estás como ausente. I like it. You can translate that in various ways, but one of them is, you know, I like it when you shut up, because it's as if you're not there, which would be a kind of rough kind of gist translation. So when you've got lines like that, or in some of the love poems from the Versos del Capitán, where, you know, he sort of describes himself as tearing his lover to shreds, where you've got this combination of self-fashioning and also lines that today, you know, kind of at best they feel a bit cringy, that's not something you can really skirt around. Similarly with the politics as well. I mean, Neruda is, you know, the great poet of political protest, you know, the renowned for his Civil War verses, for his condemnation of dictatorships across Latin America. You know, he's a poet quoted even today in, you know, political protests. People will cite lines from Neruda as slogans and put them on banners. But at the same time, you've got collections like Las Uvas y el Viento, you know, The Grapes and the Wind, where, and we were talking about this earlier, and I couldn't remember whether it was mythological or it really is, but there really are lines talking about Stalin miraculously increasing tractor production. And I suppose, again, it kind of comes back to someone like Adorno, that actually, the question really to address is in the form. And in some of those lines, just reading that particular poem again, is it's so prosaic and it's so sort of dutiful that you can see the problems of the politics coming out in the political form, in the poetic form, rather.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I always think of in Neruda is because of my work on the mid-1940s in Mexico. He's there bookending the 1940s as the ambassador who goes to Kairos the way out of the country after the assassination attempt on Trotsky, and then later seeking exile himself and kind of framing this early Cold War period and really spotting, I think I sent you this quote about the Reader's Digest and the torture manual, and seeing that the Cold War was going to be something that was simultaneously repressive and ideological.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it's all very well being able to speak these amazing truths, but we know what else is lurking within the verses, not only within his autobiography.
No, that's right. And of course he had this very interesting relationship with the Communist Party, and the Chilean Communist Party has this reputation for being certainly, you know, both socially one of the most conservative parties of the international communist parties, but also of course it was one that was, you know, it was very obedient to Moscow. And it's really interesting kind of charting the history of his relationship with, you know, with Stalin, with politics in Russia, and this debate that he seems to be having within himself between party discipline and his more kind of rebellious, artistic, even anarchist impulses. I mean, that was his, you know, his early politics, his very early politics in his teens was a kind of youthful anarchism. But then in the, you know, in the sort of early 50s, he's writing these very dutiful Stalinist verses. And then, of course, you know, with Khrushchev and with the revelation of Stalin's crimes, he then has this moment of sort of rethinking his politics. And a collection like Estravagario is really interesting because he discovers humour, he discovers sort of self-ironisation, and it seems to be as a function of rethinking his own politics and rethinking the kind of discipline and the sort of, you know, the kind of the various twists that he'd had to make to justify his very sort of disciplined and obedient political position in the 40s and in the 40s and 50s.
And at the same time, he was rather prescient on a number of matters.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And again, it comes out particularly in Edwards' memoir, which is he was relatively early in coming to see the Stalinization of Cuba, for example. And he had this very difficult relationship with Cuba. And you'd think, as the great political poet of the left in Latin America, he'd have gone on absolutely wonderfully with the revolution. But, I mean, he saw and he warned very early, both privately and also in poems like his Canción de Gesta, which is his nominally his celebration of the Cuban Revolution, but he's already there warning about the cult of personality, personalization, and about the kind of hardening of the revolution, which is, in a sense, something that very much did happen in the late 60s and the early 70s. And the other thing as well, also, that although he's so closely associated with Allende, he was very aware of some of the political risks of the early 70s. And not long before his death, he said, look, there's going to be a coup and the military are going to be around for a long time. And although maybe in public he was sounding more optimistic and even sort of voluntarist about the Chilean situation, he was at times quite clear-sighted. He had actually, in some respects, a very clear understanding of national politics, which maybe we don't associate with the sort of more idealized images of the poet in his house on the shore at Isla Negra.
Yeah. Well, sobering point at which to wrap things up, I think, there. Well, thank you very much, Ben Bolig, for speaking to Radical Americas.
You're welcome.
And many thanks to Ben Bolig there. Finally, in this episode, I spoke to Neil Geraghty.
This is William Booth for the Radical Americas podcast. I'm here at the British Library talking with Neil Geraghty, who's a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of Latin American Studies, University of London.
Morning, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. We're going to talk, first of all, about a forthcoming article that you've got in Memory Studies, which is entitled Sonorous Memory in Jonathan Perel's El Predio and Los Murales, which are two films, his first two films. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit, first of all, about what is interesting and unusual about these movies.
Yeah, so I guess what's interesting, I think, most interesting about Jonathan Perel is that he now has seven films that have this remarkably consistent aesthetic. All his films consist of fixed shots of protracted duration of objects and spaces closely related to the last military dictatorship in Argentina. None of them feature any human characters of note, and they only feature diegetic sounds and incidental action, if you like. So they're very experimental documentaries, but some of the most interesting films, I think, that have been made in recent years on the topic of memory.
Yeah, and the role of sound is really central to your work on these films in this article.
Yeah, that's right. I think Perel himself quite often suggests that his films are constructed from el silencio y el vacío, no? But I'm sort of, I've been questioning that to a certain degree, and I sort of borrowed John Cage's maxim that there's no such thing as silence, and there's a richness to the silence, if you like, that is present in all Perel's films. So this, the forthcoming article is focusing on the first two, but the other really interesting thing is that by restricting the techniques available to him for constructing documentaries, the seven films are incredibly different from these same simple blocks of technical blocks. They produce very different meanings in different contexts.
And the sound is obviously crucial, but the locations of these lingering shots are also important to some degree, aren't they?
Yeah, massively so. Yeah. That's absolutely the case. So his first film, El Predio, was filmed in the ex-ESMA, so during the last dictatorship, the primary clandestine torture and extermination centre. And it was recorded just in the period of time, a very specific historical moment when the building was transferring into the hands of human rights organisations who were reclaiming the site and turning it into a space for memory and human rights. So it's an incredibly important space. And part of what I talk about is that the space itself is so effectively saturated that it has a incredible emotional resonance, even though Perel does not film any sort of recognizable spaces in this site. The site's very large, it's 17 hectares or so, but it's all very unusual and awkward angles, and it's very difficult to orientate yourself in this space. Which again, something that I talk about at various points is that, in a certain sense, that I think Perel appropriates certain techniques that were used by the dictatorship to torture and to make people feel incredibly uncomfortable and disorientated during their detainment. So it's on record that it was quite common for people to be moved around the buildings and for them to be kept in unusual spaces so they never knew where they were. And even in some instances for parts of the buildings to be redesigned so that people were never sure where they were or what was happening.
Yeah, so the affective quality is untraceable or unreachable in a way that reflects the kind of concrete reality of not necessarily torture techniques, but the life around that, the atmosphere that is created by the regime, and the difficulty of, I suppose, uncovering those memories as well, with the generation removed.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But then the space can never be separated from those things. Yeah. Like they're omnipresent and. It's everywhere there, always.
Yeah.
That's from the play of shadow and light to as I said before, the funny angles and the focus on different objects. Like everything carries this resonance of what we know has happened there.
Yeah.
Paradoxically, by stripping everything away, these things become more present. I think.
And is Perel's work very well known internationally?
Within Argentina, it's certainly very well known. I realise that's exactly the opposite of what you asked.
Well, that's important to know as well.
But he's, I think, a very important filmmaker and voice. And I think around the festival circuit internationally, it started to become increasingly known. I believe that Toponymia, which was his most recent feature-length film, is available on iTunes and stuff, and it's definitely worth watching. It's a similar kind of documentary, but in a different space.
And
I would recommend his films to anyone.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll put a link to that in the blurb under the podcast then. Now, you've also got a book forthcoming and an edited volume, and we'll come back to talk about the edited volume in a moment, but the book is called The Polyphonic Machine, Capitalism, Political Violence and Resistance in Contemporary Argentine Literature. Give us the thrust of that if you can.
I'm looking at three different authors, Cesar Aira, Marcelo Cohen and Ricardo Piglia. And it's about looking at how they respond to the experience of state terrorism and a longer history of political violence in Argentina. It's not purely focused on the most recent dictatorship. And then, looking at all three authors are quite experimental in their own way, and looking at how these experiments can lead to sort of new philosophical conceptions of being and resistance that work against capitalism and political violence, which seem to have been intertwined for at least the last century and a bit in Argentina.
How all-consuming or omnipresent is the interaction with dictatorship in contemporary Argentine literature? Is it impossible to escape?
No, I mean, there's so much literature from Argentina. I'm sure it's not the case for every writer that they're all obsessed with the dictatorship. But it, certainly the three writers that I'm focusing on are of a generation where I'm sure that is in some ways the defining period of their lives. They're not all exactly of a same generation. Biglia is slightly older and Cohen is slightly younger, but they're broadly in that period. And I suppose maybe that's a danger for us academics, to read everything through the lens of dictatorship, where not everything is. But certainly that's what I'm focusing on.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I think there's a danger in reading all the political conflicts in contemporary Argentina as a kind of proxy war of things that happened several decades ago, but actually, you know, in some cases it does come through very clearly that there are links there. In other cases, people are perhaps projecting rather.
I mean, insofar as Peronism is still the defining feature of Argentine politics for both sides of a very dichotomous split, and I think that is still the case now, and has been the case for a long time. But the tendency to see things in cycles and repetitions is very definitely there.
Yeah.
At the same time, it seems like another dictatorship is unthinkable. So something has changed.
Yeah.
Without a shadow of a doubt, and undoubtedly, the people putting in a tremendous amount of memory labour have caused that break, supported by sympathetic governments and politicians, by the sort of grassroots communities and activists that are involved in that kind of memory labour. I think they've forged this novelty, this difference. But that's not to say that there aren't dangerous things occurring happening in contemporary Argentina, which there obviously are.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And then the edited volume is co-edited with Dr. Adriana Maceda, Creative Spaces, Urban Culture and Marginality in Latin America. Mm-hmm. She can just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's a slightly different project. Adriana Maceda is an architect and urban historian who looks at the Argentine villas, and the book sort of came out of us talking together about what might be considered as marginal spaces, and then we've got this collection coming out that really focuses on trying to, without being blind to the very serious problems and difficulties that informal and marginal spaces encounter in everyday experience, focus on the creative potential that's there and what's happening there. So we have various chapters that are sort of from the more cultural studies side. We co-authored a paper ourselves that's looking at a couple of Argentine films. We have some more that are more from planning and some more sociological papers. So it's looking at a very broad definitions of both creativity and of marginality.
It sounds like a really interesting interdisciplinary project, though. Was it easy to get coherence between the interdisciplinary approaches, or was the subject matter strong enough to just pull everything in? It sounds like it was.
Yeah, I think it was born out of a conference, first of all, and by having these central strands, marginality and creativity, it does give things a certain coherence. It keeps things together, and I think those two sort of axes work well to keep it all together. But then there's plenty of scope to look at different national contexts and different disciplines and different elements. And it's been a really, for us as editors, it's been really rewarding to read these papers and really think about what marginality is, or even what creativity is.
I think doing Latin American studies as well, you know, whether you kind of buy into it or not, it definitely exists as a discipline and departments within universities and so on. there does seem to be much more of a necessity and, I think, on the whole, a willingness to be interdisciplinary and to, and certainly thinking about putting together any kind of bibliography on contemporary Mexico, I'd definitely be including things from literature and anthropology and so on, and I guess the same is true for Argentina.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely fortunate and probably biased in that all of my academic career has been inside first the Centre of Latin American Studies at Cambridge and then the Institute of Latin American Studies, so I'm very much in that sort of area studies frame of mind, which is inherently interdisciplinary, but I think presumably for studying any other a culture other than your own, like adopting a broad range is the only way you're going to not fully understand, but come closer to fulfilling your understanding of a place.
Yeah, I think that's a good attitude to take into our studies in the future.
Thanks to Neil Geraghty, Ben Bollig and Camila Gattaca. Links to the works we discussed will be in the blurb under the podcast.